Now entering Nerdist.com.
You made it weird. You made it weird. You made it weird. Oh, yeah. You made it weird. You made it weird.
Yes, you did.
You made it weird. Oh, yeah.
You made it weird with Pete Holmes.
What's up, weirdos? What a great episode. Dwight Slade, a friend of mine for a very long time, and just a tremendous person. I know I always say this, but I really do just want to get to it. So let's do it. You Made It Movies is now available right now for download. Just search You Made It Weird on iTunes. There's Assassination of Jesse James. There's There Will Be Blood with Paul F. Tompkins. It's basically, if you've ever wanted to watch a movie with me and one of the guests from the show, you watch the movie, you play the podcast, and it's like we're all hanging out. I think it's a fun idea, and I hope you like it. Check it out. Also, February 1st and 2nd in San Francisco for Sketchfest with a live You Made It Weird on February 2nd at Cobb's. And Madison, Wisconsin, going to be there February 21 through 23 for Comedy Club on State, and Grand Rapids, Michigan, on March 9th for Gilda's Laugh Fest. You got it. The sponsor is Amazon, I guess. You know what to do. Go to Nerdist.com, click on the Amazon banner, shop. That supports the show. You can also make donations directly to the show at YouMadeItWeird.com through PayPal, or buy some t-shirts made by weirdos and for weirdos. That's it. Everybody, get into it. Email your favorite moments to ComedySexGod@gmail.com with the time code and the description of the moment, and we'll include it in a best of CD that we're putting together. And email me, weird@nerdist.com. And in the meantime, enjoy my friend, the amazing Dwight Slade, everybody.
It's cold in here. Good. Good for broadcasting.
That's good. Good. Reduce this fever I have.
Look at that phone. That's that
Galaxy Note, yeah.
Yeah, that's the it's bigger. I'll just tell you what you need to know about your own phone. It's a larger phone, Dwight.
In very technical terms.
I can't hear myself. I can't hear my own voice. I can't hear. Oh, there I am. Oh, that's so much better. No, then it's gone again. I got it. You got to jiggle. Dwight, there's a jiggle system.
Well, his should be okay.
Yours will be fine.
You hit yours.
Good. I have an app for a jiggle.
You have a jiggle app?
I do.
I don't understand. I haven't. When was the last time I saw you? Portland? Bridgetown?
Yes.
Is that right?
I've never seen you on your home turf.
That's weird, right?
Except in Chicago.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But you get this a lot. You talk about it in your act. You look younger and younger.
I know.
What's happening?
Well, I eat stem cells. I have a strict diet.
See, that has to be somewhat true. Are you eating a lot of vegetables?
I bathe in placenta.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
Can you please help me? I thought about this. I've known you so long, you're in my phone as Dwight Cell. Like back when you had to be like home cell. You're Dwight Cell.
Nice.
That's a long time.
Well, you have a perpetually baby face, don't you?
I do have a bit of a babe. Yeah, babe face. Babe face. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. But you get that a lot.
But you're 8 feet tall, so.
You're also tall.
It's, yeah. The baby face can be creepy.
Because it's so high up.
Right. There's a tall man coming. He's a baby!
It's very unpleasant for everybody involved. It's good to see you, man.
Oh, God. Likewise.
I need to take a moment up top and collect my thoughts and my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this beginning of a comedy show. I hosted a show last night. I hadn't hosted in a long time. And I always like to remind myself and the crowd that everybody's tense at the top of a show. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, when I went and saw a comedy show, a stand-up show, a long, long time ago, but I had been a comedian for a while, I was sitting in the crowd and I was like, oh, my God, everyone's anxious.
Yeah.
Especially the people in the front. That's why they're all getting liquored up and stuff. It's tense.
Yeah.
Like, they don't know what kind of show it's going to be.
Yeah. And have you ever had family or friends in the audience?
Yes.
They are so tense for you.
Of course.
That's why I hate anybody coming to a show.
Thank you.
That's a universal thing, I think, amongst comics. But whenever I hear this, we're going to come and support you.
Yeah.
Don't support
Wait.
Me. I don't want. We're going to sit in the front row. Don't sit in the front row. Don't
come. You have that story. You have that story of Christmas. Do you remember?
What Christmas?
You told me. There's this thing. I worked with somebody when I was writing on television. There was somebody that I would occasionally, they would haggle me out of prices. They would haggle me. And they would be like, when are you performing? And because they asked, I was like, well, I happen to have a show tonight. And then the next day, no one would have gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then there'd be a guy who would go like, I couldn't make your show. Like, I didn't ask you to come to my
right.
show. Yeah. And that's your story.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. No,
you were home for Christmas and like some weird uncle or something.
No, I had a cousin or actually it was a niece and her husband.
Yeah.
Was a guy who made $90,000 a year. And the reason I know he made $90,000 a year is because he would constantly tell everyone he made $90,000 a year.
No.
And just would drop it. And everyone else in the family would go. And this is the time I was married, and my in-laws were impressed by $90,000 a year. In fact, it was the most money anyone had ever heard of in my ex-in-laws.
We didn't know the numbers went that high per year.
I know. They were like, they had to have a private conference. Come in here. $90,000 is what this man makes.
And so he didn't even bump it up to 100.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
He kept it honest.
We I would have believed 100.
Why wouldn't you?
But 90.
Yeah.
And it was because of a pizza restaurant that he ran. And, which is suspect in itself. I'd like to see receipts. I don't believe you made $90,000. And so within the family dynamic, he was a king. He was.
Yes.
And he would lord over all the cousins and in-laws over Thanksgiving and Christmas. And he'd sit there and you'd walk in and he'd have his hands over his head and I'd walk through the room, and I'm like, acknowledging.
Like he's perpetually stretching? You mean his hands were up?
Yeah, right over
his top. That's a status move.
Yeah.
That's like if you see a wolf or a bear, you try to make yourself look bigger.
Yes.
He was like, look how big I am.
He'd cross his hands over the top of his head.
90,000 tall.
Right. And legs would be sticking out, crossed.
So power move.
Yes, exactly.
Power move.
And really unnecessary, because within this family, he had all the power he could possibly muster.
You won already.
Yes.
Relax.
You are 90 grand ahead. So I'm walking through, and he goes, Dwight! It's not like touching me. It's like screaming across the room, Dwight! Hey, when are we going to see you on the Tonight Show? When are we going to see you on Comedy Central? I was like, yeah. And I'm like, well...
You told me, I remember this detail specifically, you go, it just so happened.
It just so happened.
Because Premium Blend was the show, right?
Right.
And that show airs very, very sporadically.
Mm-hmm.
But you happened to like get an email or something, and you knew your Premium Blend was airing.
Well, they at the time, they were repeating it quite a bit, because I happened to luck out, and I got on the same show as some incredibly great comics.
Right.
And my set wasn't quite the slouch either.
Yes.
So they replayed it. So I told him, I go, well, as a matter of fact, it's on Tuesday.
You cocksucker.
At 9 p.m.
If you have cable with your 90 grand,
right.
Tune in.
And he goes, going to the Blazer game. Sorry, can't make it.
Oh,
so yet it's like I'm the one who's like, suddenly I look like a dick.
It's like you're asking, please, would you watch it?
Right.
Please come to my show. That's why.
No, can't make it. Sorry.
Yeah.
Going to the Blazer game.
I go home. Oh, God. What's this man's name? Can you say his first name?
I can't.
You probably can't. I just want to know if he sounds like a Phil or something. Or like a, I don't know, Davey.
Wouldn't that be great?
If it were Phil. Anyway, I'm not going to put you on that spot. I go home now, and my mother, Irina, will tell me things like, oh, my chiropractor wants to come and see you. And I'll be like, Mom, I don't want your chiropractor to come and see me. And she's like, why not? She just wants to show me off. She's got a good heart and good intentions. But I'm like, because that's humiliating. It's like, please come to my show. It's support my show.
No, you don't,
please
I don't need
come?
Support.
Yeah. Don't support. Strangers are where it's at.
I'm embarrassed by my life already. I don't need you to heighten that feeling.
And you don't know how it's going to go.
Of course not.
You don't
even
know
if
how
it goes
gonna...
well.
Yes.
You're still full of self-loathing afterwards.
Well, not me. I burn white hot with manic joy. Not every time. But if it goes poorly, and there is a weird thing that even if it goes well, there's something immodest about it.
Mm-hmm.
I've had that experience. Not mm-hmm. And I have had the dread after a good set. Don't get me wrong. I happen to be in an upswing right now.
Good.
I
need this then. I need to be around you.
I know. Oh, that's so funny that you say that. Lately, I noticed, I took my temperature in some way that I don't know how. I was like, I have to.
Are you ovulating? What do you, you mean taking your temperature?
You know, I checked in with myself.
Hurry, honey, I'm fertile. You're a man. I don't care.
But these are fresh. Pointing to my balls. These are fresh and ready. Remember when I was so clean? You met me when I was so clean. Anyway, the point was I realized I had to hang out with positive people. I had dinner. Did I already talk about this on the show? I had dinner with Gerard Carmichael, who's like makes me look like fucking Gargamel.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. This is like white burning constellation of a man.
Wow.
It's funny that you – but it's funny. So many of my friends are negative, and I like that because it keeps my manic, like I said, mm-hmm. this energy – balanced and in check, and I don't want to be a lunatic that's only just like all the time. But lately I've been feeling a little bit down, then I started hanging out with more positive people and it rubs off on
really?
You.
Really? Okay.
So it's funny that you said that.
My question though is the positivity and maybe it doesn't make any difference, but is the positivity genuine, or is it sort of a choice where I'm going to choose to be more positive? Because what I find is that I'm so effing grateful about life, and sometimes you walk by a stained glass picture and the light's hitting it that you're just awash with.
Yes.
This is a great day. You know, like I was in Portland yesterday, I'm in Los Angeles, and it's sunny, and there's plants, growth, and there's people without a lot of clothes on.
Yes, yes, yes.
People who have their coats at home.
Yeah, you leave the coat at home.
And I'm just awash with that, and so that I find that when I'm in normal activity,
yes,
I can't sustain that. And so I purposely downgrade myself.
Well, Dwight, your brain is it's a differential system. That's what it is.
Differential.
So it'll you should write it down. You know where I have that written down? On a post-it right above my refrigerator.
Differential system?
I believe I wrote differential engine is what it is.
Engine.
So your brain.
Wow. It'd be awful if the refrigerator repairman mistook that for a note to be what? I think the engine needs to be replaced.
Every time he comes in, he replaces the engine. The note's up. I got to do it. The point being, you're doing something very obvious. Like, if you're a billionaire and I give you $50,000, it doesn't matter because you've already adjusted to the idea of being wealthy. If you're cold, Portland, and then you come to heat, that's the easiest time for your brain to be happy. Hmm. It's why if I torture you for 10 years and then put you in Idaho, you're like, fucking Idaho! You love Idaho. I don't mean to shit on Idaho.
Well, but actually, that equation goes both ways. If you go to Idaho, it feels like 10 years of torture.
Or if you're in Idaho and I put you in 10 years of torture, you're like, at least I'm not in Idaho.
Right.
Bring out them pliers. I don't know why he talks that way. Is Idaho in the South? Couldn't tell you where it is on a map.
No. People wish they were in the South in Idaho.
That's how bad it is. It would have more identity if we were Southern.
God.
But anyway, so I'm interested in what you're saying. And my enthusiasm today is very genuine. I'm very happy to see you. I woke up just kind of like, oh, good day. Nothing really stressful. Mm-hmm. Other times it is a choice. Other times, which I have been going through this darker for me time, and then it is conditioning. It really is like a and I'm fortunate to have the brain that can do that, that can manipulate itself into being a little bit happier. And it's funny that you say gratitude because that's everybody will point you to gratitude. Everybody. Mm-hmm. Alcoholics Anonymous. And then all the way to just, you know, your run-of-the-mill self-help person will be like, look at like what you did. Look at that stained glass window. Look at the light coming in. Look at the fact that I live in a time that a plane took me from Portland to here with ease.
Exactly.
It's all around us. Look at this table. Look at this paper.
Well, it's not get ridiculous, but yeah, I understand. This table is a piece of shit. I don't know if you've taken a look at it, but...
But, like, there's no...
Yes.
There's no thing you couldn't be grateful for.
True.
Your skin, your eyes, both your hands. Like, I got these coffees for us, and the woman was like, do you need a carrier? This is going to sound stupid, but I sound stupid on the show all the time. So I got us these coffees. She goes, do you need a carrier? And I go, no. And as I'm walking out, this is so stupid. I said, God gave me two coffees. God gave me two hands. And it made me happy. And I'm not talking about like a literal God. It just was like a nice little, I've been blessed with being able to get these coffees.
And two homeless people gave you change. Nice one, brother. Nice one. Come get some soup at the kitchen. No. I'm trying to be positive.
Are you saying that they would use that line? That's like hobo wisdom? Or are you saying I should then look at a homeless person and go, what a bunch of bullshit.
Hobo wisdom.
Hobo wisdom. I just want to be clear that you did mean hobo wisdom.
Right.
Okay, hobo. It does sound like hobo wisdom. But it kind of worked.
Yeah.
It's stupid. Mm-hmm. I can make myself cry in the car listening to music and thinking about friends. That's how stupid our brain is. So we can either do that, and we do that for a long enough time, and you get a person like me. Or you are negative, and you do that a long time, and maybe you end up just defaulting. What do you default to? Like, you wake somebody up in the middle of the night. I think you can tweak your default setting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that, yeah.
Are you not as upbeat as you want to be?
Well, I have a lot to be grateful for, and I'm coming out of a dark period, and so not a dark period, but just there was I lost two brothers and a father in a year and a half. Just one of those things where it's like,
oh my god!
Just every time the phone rang, you were like, well, what is it this time?
Really?
Hello, tell me what the bad news.
Put that in my two hands, two coffee.
Right.
How come I do it? Two brothers and your father?
Yeah, and so it was a miserable. And oddly enough, though, one of the most productive years of my life is when it all happened. I was going full tilt in my career, but since then it's just been sort of a reorganization, and I feel like I'm coming out of that now, and I'm really happy and excited about what lies ahead.
God,
you put the stuff behind you.
I'm happy you're saying that because I kind of feel like a fool, because that's the truth. The truth is, we live in a wonderful world, stained glass, magic. It's magical. We also live in a world where two brothers and a father died.
Yeah, you just,
what?
Yeah, just crazy.
Unrelated?
Well, two of them cancer, and one of them was an accident. So yeah.
Oh my god.
So, but you process it, and part of the it takes years to process it, and you never process it completely. You have when you have trauma or grief, but you get through it.
Isn't it? I've been thinking a little bit about like how we kind of use delusion. Like delusion seems to be a requirement for sanity, almost. Like you have to find some way to spin these things and move past them. Because the truth is, we could die at any moment. Your loved ones could die at any moment. Like we live in a very fragile place, but we delude ourselves and go, I have coffee in hands and I'm going to watch Jack the Preacher. I haven't seen it. But you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's also popcorn and sex and food, and there's a steak, and the steak is also something that died. You know what I mean? Like, but we're just surrounded by grief, and that makes me sad. But at the same time, there's banjos and ukuleles and butterflies.
I would eliminate banjo from that list, but I'm on par with you. But I think that, and one would argue that it is those valleys that create the peaks, and I accept that, and it actually is very true.
Yeah,
that when you process this stuff, it makes you your capacity, the level of your heart growing and expanding, becomes bigger and better.
Yeah,
and that's that creates joy, and also creates a good sense of cynicism. And that's one of my coping tools is cynicism, humor.
Sarcasm.
I deflect with cynicism and self-deprecation and, whatever the list is. I think that's part of the delusion that you were
Well, you're building up the walls pretty good.
Yes.
Your sense of humor can block a lot of this stuff out.
Right.
That's what Bill Cosby said. He said, if you're funny, you can get through anything, even poverty, because he grew up quite poor. So he had all that material about the linoleum and his brothers and sharing beds and all that sort of stuff. And he made it through. And now look at him. He lives in a house that he bought with iSpy money. You know what I mean? Like, he hasn't needed money since the 70s. So he's doing great, and that's wonderful. So you build up all that stuff. And, for me, every part of stand-up is a denial of death a little bit. I was talking to my therapist about this. I was like, even just the act of me going up on stage, I think I'm afraid of dying. Let's start there. So much so that part of the enjoyment for me of stand-up is being seen by a group of people. And I joked to my therapist, I was like, I want them to applaud my presence, my thoughts, I want to breathe in, and they go, he's breathing in, and exhale and have them applaud, be like, he's doing it again. And then I'm not proud of this. This is my vulnerable self right now. But like that, I get off stage and I feel a lot. I don't feel afraid of dying when I get off stage. I feel empathy is up. I feel our connectivity is up, and I'm not afraid to die in that moment.
Well, John Bradshaw, who's a family therapist, and he did a series on the family on PBS. He also is responsible for the inner child movement, which he's been much maligned for. But his work on the family is second to none. Mm-hmm. And he contends that that's when we're born and we're the infant and we have that blank slate, that it's filled primarily with the face of the mother, with those two eyes looking at you and approving of you, that we don't have the capability as children and infants to filter.
Right.
And if your mom is looking at you and there's some issue with your mom, which of course there is issues with every mom,
sure,
with every family, it's transferred to the infant without question.
I agree with this.
And so that's why in recovery, groups are so important because there's faces. And yeah. that's why I think stand-up, you're right, is we're drawn to stand-up because we're in a room full of people who are smiling at you.
Yeah.
And you see those faces.
Yeah.
I go through periods of time, and I don't know what this says about my mental state, where I don't look at the audience. I don't look at faces.
You look down.
I look at the candles. I look at blank spaces between the faces. I never make eye contact.
Now, currently.
Well, currently I am going through that, and occasionally I'll break through it and see people and look in their eyes, but I don't know why I can't handle that. I guess because I look in their eyes and I see their whole life.
No, is that true? I'm overwhelmed by people.
Yeah.
I'm overwhelmed. This is weird. Me and Eugene Merman thought it would be funny to go to a strip club last night because we thought it would be crowded and would just kind of people watch and stuff. And then here from Portland, this doesn't freak you out.
No.
So we went over and like it. Look, it doesn't make it's not heartbreaking, but the reason I can't enjoy a strip club, I've never been aroused in a strip club. It's the least sexual place in the world.
I'm with you.
Is I look them in the eye I just see the entire story, whether or not it's a sad story. I don't want to assume that they're miserable.
Sure.
But I am like, what kind of car do you have? Like, do you share those heels with the other girls? Like, I want, and that's all I want. And then I bought everybody a drink, all the strippers a drink, and they kept being like, getting a lap dance. But I can't because of the faces. There's too much intel.
Yes.
Too much. That's what you're experiencing.
That's true. That's
Is
true.
It because you're in an overwhelming emotional time of loss in a difficult place?
I think it's just about boundaries in terms of not looking at it. But also I think it's an issue of perception that you do. You look at people and you – well, you know, years ago I – my brother gave me a, quote, reading from a guy who was a channeler.
Mm-hmm.
This was back in the 80s. And he's a pretty interesting guy.
So you went to a reader?
Well, it was over the phone. He was a channeler. And my brother was like, hey, this guy, not bad. Mm-hmm. You'll get something out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he did say some things that have since come true. So he obviously perceived some things.
When did you talk to him?
Back in the 80s.
Oh, I'm sorry. You already said that.
Yeah. Okay. And But one of the things he said was that as a performer, when you go on stage, he said that you should purify, you should picture white light coming from your stomach to the audience. And the reason is because when you go up in front of the audience, you form a connection with the audience. That's why live entertainment is so fulfilling. It's because even though there's, you know, maybe 700 people in the crowd, you still have a tiny connection to the performer, and that's intoxicating,
mm-hmm.
especially if you love the performer and their work and their art. But as a performer, when you're up there, you can get overwhelmed by stuff, and
that's
there can be some slosh coming back and forth to between the connection to you and the audience. So you come off the stage, and suddenly you've absorbed a ton of energy from this group of people, which you don't know.
Uh-huh.
So he said, just picture you're purifying between your solar plexus and the audience, and so I think now I haven't been doing that, and so I avoid connecting with
Isn't
the crowd.
So, yeah. I feel this is something that's
long
so,
explanation.
No, longer, please. I couldn't have been more interesting. The things that help us get our shit together require us having our shit together. That's something I wrote down recently because it's like. You want to be happy or exercise. But to exercise, I need to be happy. If I wake up and I'm depressed, I'm not going to go on a hike, even though I know the hike would help me. And you're saying, like, if I went up and looked at them and connect, but that's those actions come from a good place.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going up and you don't feel that way. So it's a wonder we ever get there.
Right.
Something bumps you, a friend, something in your work, something in your family, somebody loves you and gives you that boost. And then you go up there and maybe you can look them in the eye, and the white light comes from mm-hmm. your belly all of a sudden.
Right, right. And it's like you were talking earlier about a decision. You just decide.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that. And a lot of power in decision.
I completely agree. I forgot how touchy-feely, in the best of ways, because I'm right there with you. Touchy-feely sounds like it's negative, but I just mean like how open you are to that sort of stuff. I remember you told me about The Artist's Way. That was like a book that you really appreciated. Do you remember that? You told me about the morning pages. You'd wake up and you would write.
Yeah.
When I'm doing that, Jesus, my life is going well.
Yeah.
Like if I have the will to get up and write my thoughts.
Yeah.
And then I notice when I riff. Okay, so the idea is first thing in the morning before you do anything, you write.
Right.
And you just freestyle write.
Right.
You don't criticize yourself. You let it all out. And when I do that, I notice that then if I perform that night and I improvise, I'll draw upon what I wrote.
Wow.
Because it exists now. It's a thing now.
Wow.
It has an energy, I guess you could say.
Yes.
And then I remember it. And then I say it. That's why there are Post-its all over my apartment, like a lunatic. Because now when I riff, something will come out that I wrote on the Post-it.
Interesting.
Just kind of my material is kind of, avalanching on top of me constantly. Otherwise, I'll never work.
Yeah, Julia Cameron really did a breakthrough with The Artist's Way, and you do. And the point is, you do three pages because you have to push yourself like twice. You have to, because you start writing and you're like, "Well, that's it." Mm-hmm. And then Julia instructs you very thoroughly in The Artist's Way. Push, do yes. another page, yeah. and then you do want to stop. Then you're sick of it.
Yeah.
And she says, "Then push yourself because that's where the real meat comes out is yeah. when you do the third push."
Yeah.
And here's two other exercises you can do that I've sort of co-opted from that.
Please.
One was drawn on a guy named Robert Bly, who's a poet, and he wrote a book called Iron John. He's responsible for a lot of the men's movement by going out and banging drums and whatnot, but mm-hmm. that's immaterial. One exercise that he did was he would roll out of bed and literally roll out of bed, pick up a sheet of paper, write a poem for 20 minutes.
Really?
Every morning.
Oh,
very difficult, yeah. but very valuable.
Yes.
And the second one is no words, no writing, sketching, as you just draw. Even if you're not a good drawer. In fact, the worst drawer you are,
yeah.
you should do that exercise. Yeah. Well, 30 minutes, you should draw right first thing in the morning.
It's so interesting that you say. I sketched something just today for the first time, and I was like, this feels good. There's something – it's nice to do something tangible. We do this intangible thing where you were talking about the connecting with the crowd and the words and the moment mm-hmm. and this connection, and then it's gone. You know, there's something kind of Tibetan about that. We sweep it away. And then just drawing something and go, this is here. I just mm-hmm. drew Spider-Man in a suit and tie. And I go, here's Spider-Man. That's here. He exists. There's a nice feeling to that.
Would anyone know it was Spider-Man? Or is it just someone go, this is a guy in a suit and tie? No, he's Spider-Man. The spider outfit is underneath the clothes. I didn't draw it. But it's there inherently.
You need to believe. Well, he's wearing the mask.
Okay.
Which is always something funny. I like drawing superheroes in like banal office jobs because I think it's kind of funny. Like it speaks to like our inner potential. Like he's waiting in line for a copy machine and he just kind of looks depressed because he's fucking Spider-Man, right. but he works for fucking Hank, the right. dick, in the corner office. I'm very interested in that energy thing. I've always likened performing, and I want to see what you think about this. There's almost something sexual about it, the give and the take and the attention being paid, like all the eye contact and stuff. Maybe it's not sex. Maybe it's love in the sense that like there's certain no one would argue that the performer is being loved. But I think the audience is being loved as well, because a good stand up, when you're talking about somebody that you really are excited to see, you're one of the laughs in the crowd. You're one of the sounds. You're forming this collective that's the audience that's informing the performer. And the performer, if he's good, his act – I'm not saying he needs to be riffing or improvising or changing his content, but he's riding that wave sure. that they're providing, which is why some shows are better than others. That's another catch-22. When the crowd is good, the show is usually better. Mm-hmm. But anyway, what do you think of that, that relationship?
Well, I think it's a very fundamental thing that you've kind of discovered, which I would call listening and answering, which is an acting term also.
Oh, yes. You told me about – you got to talk about that. After you're saying what you're saying, yeah. don't forget to tell me – you told me you took a wonderful acting course.
Yeah. I was a student for 3 years with Laurel anyway, I can't remember her last name, Raffan, but she was a student of Stanford Meisner. Who was one of the group theater's original founders and along with Stella Adler created a system of a Meisner technique, which is listening and answering. Mm-hmm. And listening and answering without words. It's an improvisational technique mm-hmm. that he created, and it's like the abdominals of acting, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. There's no greater benefit than doing listening and answering in terms of Meisner.
What does that mean? What is listening and what is answering?
Well, listening is it's also the pinch and the response. It's like if I gave you a line and the line is fire truck, mm-hmm. and then I said, when you feel something, say fire truck, and I pinched you, mm-hmm. and right, you go fire truck
right.
because I pinched you,
right.
and it kind of hurt.
Right.
The point is that I've given you a line and I've given you information, and you're listening to the pinch and answer.
Uh-huh.
So listening and answering is very much it's not about me; it's about you. I have to listen to you
and
respond to what you're giving me.
Right.
And what I find with performing in front of a live crowd is it takes a long time to be able to look out at a crowd and to feel the crowd. And maybe this is why I don't look at them, because I want to feel them. Mm. Is is to answer to what they're giving me. Mm-hmm. And sometimes what they're giving me is not through the ears. It's just a sense. Mm-hmm. And it changes the way the performance goes. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it becomes a little choppy. Or I remember just two nights ago, I was looking out and it looked like I live in Portland, Oregon, and I was doing shows in Portland, and there is a high population of slacker and hipsters, and they are fortunately coming to the comedy clubs.
Slipsters.
But they don't – I find that this type of demographic coming to comedy shows doesn't really like the hard-hitting comedy, the traditional –
The polish.
Right, the polish.
They're turned off by polish.
Right. And so I kind of tuned into that, and I pulled back on that – six laughs a minute or whatever.
Sure.
And relaxed, and I found that they were engaged more.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, it's the how I'm communicating, and I didn't get that information when I was listening to them. So I think that's the value of listening and answering.
That's precisely, and I think that's what a lot of, for lack of a better term, clubby guys have a hard time with, the lack of a better term, the alti scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say alternative, and I want to be very clear about this, I just mean venues. That's one of the things that's very close to me. I think the comedy is very similar. It's mm-hmm. it's where it's being performed, and it's a little bit how it's being conveyed. And what you're saying is, polish putting people off, if you can be present,
right.
they're hip to it. They know the term bit. They know the term set list. They understand the parallels between music and you. And are you being present? Are you really pretending? Are you pretending that you had an aside just mm-hmm. then?
Right.
Or are you having the aside? And they would. The premium then is on Dwight, you, as you realized in that show, and as I've also realized. What are you thinking right now? And will you trust us to not be funny right now and just be honest? I think that's pushing us in a good place. Wouldn't you say?
I agree.
It's funny because you and I, so we met in Indiana, South Bend, Indiana.
At the Funny Bone.
Yes. I'm actually going to jump ahead because we won't forget to talk about that. But I might forget to ask you about this. Years later, I was working at, you're one of the few that met my wife, my
sure.
ex-wife. Like a lot of people think she wasn't real.
Yeah. We went out to dinner.
You did? We were in South Bend, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think she came down for the, how did I do that? We only had one car.
There's a train that goes from Chicago to South
Bend. Oh, that's what she did. She took the train and we all went to supper.
Something like that.
I remember that. Yeah. But years later in Chicago, I was working at Bennigan's, remember?
On
South Michigan. And you came and we split a Southwest sampler. You're one of my heroes of comedy. You know, like you're the first guy that was kind to me. And I'm really, you want to talk about gratitude list. It was so fortuitous that I worked with you and we hit it off right away. And you were kind. That's not common. You know what I mean? A lot of guys are grumpy and dicks,
sure.
and they won't give you the time. You were gracious to me and the MCs and everybody. So anyway, we'll get back to that. Then we go and we're eating a Southwest sampler, mm-hmm. which is quesadillas, nachos, and Southwest egg rolls.
Why'd you bring – you know what? God gave you two hands. You could have carried that in.
I had the coffee. So we were eating that.
What a great podcast that would be. These two guys just chowing on a Southwest sampler. You know, morning pages.
People get so mad.
Robert Bly, he woke up, did poems. Excuse me.
Comedy is sex.
Oh, Jesus.
It's the worst thing you could eat. It's actually... All those foods, I know it was three different things, but you could tell it was molded from the same, like, plastic food substance. They just had, like, a mold in the back. So we're eating that horrible food that I wouldn't eat now, because I'm all Los Angeles. But we were eating it and loving it then. And I was waiting. You came in, and I probably sat down, and we ate. And I thought it was interesting, because you've been doing comedy a very long time. But it's so nice to see that you are still open to growing and evolving.
Mm-hmm.
Because do you remember our conversation that meal? Because... And again, the reason I mention you're my hero is I don't want to freak you out. The recorders were on. I remember everything you said.
Wow.
And everything you did. Because you remember being young and the people that you're around. You're so hungry for comedy. You probably remember everything the guys you started with said, every feeling. And then those first headliners that were nice to you on the road. So I just want to put you at ease. It's you and Gaffigan and there's Bill Burr. There's a small group of people that I will freak out and be like, remember when you sipped your Diet Coke and then you choked a little bit and then you said, comedy is magic, son? Anyway, you said to me, and I'm taking a long way around the barn to say this, is you were like, I want to push myself. I want to start saying more hard truth things, which was interesting to me because off stage you are very much that guy. On stage at that time, and this was, I don't know, 7 years ago, you were talking about how your act was kind of observational and safe. Mm-hmm. And I remember you looked kind of haunted mm-hmm. with the idea that you were like, I'm going to start going this direction. Mm-hmm. How'd that go?
It didn't. you play around and you push one way and you go another way. And it's a constant battle between this is playing to your strengths
yes.
versus growing as a craftsman or ultimately an artist. I think a lot of people throw around artists, especially in this town, and we're craftsmen. So I'll make sure that's a underscore. And there's nothing wrong with being a craftsman because that's the first, that's the door of the artist. But anyway.
You built it, too. You whittled it.
It's a constant battle between what playing to your
at.
Strength.
Yep.
Brian Regan, his strength is being Brian Regan. I don't want to see Brian Regan do anything but talk about bugs
and the
clean stuff and Gentle Ben and Pop-Tarts. Please give me
kids
more
Kids love
of that.
Honeyhead Kids. Bears love Honeyhead Kids, yes. Sorry.
God, it's just so brilliant.
You know, it's funny that you say that. I'm sorry to interrupt. It's kind of what the show is. It's me interrupting you for 2 hours. But I fantasized about Brian Regan letting me in a little bit more. Have you?
Letting us
in a little bit more.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Like,
it
would disappoint a lot of people. But I'm like, you got money. You have esteem and career. It would be a little bit of a betrayal, but if Brian wanted to go to a small room and just be like, I have no idea what happens when you die, and I'm terrified, and then was like, what happened? You
know what I mean? If he could be Brian Regan and be Brian Regan with those higher, darker corners, it would be fascinating.
If you went to dinner with him, he'd be that way,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't he? I have to admit, I've heard some stories, not specifically about, actually they are about Brian Regan, where he says really, really funny, dark hilarious things.
I don't doubt it.
And people are like, it's so weird hearing it come out of his face.
Yeah, the time I worked with him for a week in Cobb's in San Francisco years and years ago, and he it was just such a joy to watch him. But I do remember one thing is that when the audience engaged him, in my opinion, he went blank like a deer in headlights. It wasn't that he was scared. It was just like he was just that same guileless Brian Regan, like, what are we doing now?
Yeah.
Why are you talking to me?
Yeah.
But no ability to steer into improvisational.
I think I remember you telling me that, like, even if it was positive.
Right. And I saw it a couple times, and I was like, he does not engage the audience.
Right.
He just goes up and powers through this brilliantly crafted stuff.
Yes.
And so I guess that's sort of it, is the idea of playing to your strengths versus pushing as an artist.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes maybe it's not about pushing in stand-up as an artist. Maybe he does art. He does his own, you know, his own art. And so maybe that's his direction
exactly.
How he pushes himself.
And you know what? I see both sides. I started disagreeing with myself immediately. It would break my heart a little bit if Brian Regan was like, two fucking cocks came
right,
in.
Yeah, just...
I'd be like, oh, no. But I don't. I'm always concerned with picking a persona that doesn't allow me to show every side of myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching what I consider. I was just going to say your documentary. It's about Bill Hicks, but I was watching your documentary, American.
True, yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, one of the reasons I think, I don't know if this is true, we became friends was because when I met you, I had no interest in Bill Hicks.
Here's why we became friends.
Tell
because
me.
we went out to that one place that's like a dollar store, but it's full of – it's Big Lots. We went to Big Lots.
Yeah.
And I give everyone the benefit of the doubt, which is why, you know, if they're going to be dicks or if they're not funny, then the benefit of the doubt creates that pretty
sure.
quick.
Mm-hmm.
But I looked over. We were trying to pretend things to buy, and I looked over, and you had under your arm a giant spear or something that was like literally 12 feet long, and you had it under your arm, and you were just browsing, waiting for me to look at you and check you out, and it was like so fun. I looked over, and it was like as if, well, I found what I'm going to get, a giant 12-foot spear.
And it was a real spear, too.
Yeah, it was.
Because I remember you bought your kids, like, a crossbow
that day. I did.
Because it was a weird weapon store.
It was, yeah, it was weird.
It was like a Big Lots that also sold weapons.
Yes.
Okay.
And so that's why.
I love that. I couldn't be happier. And I want to break down every beat of that. But the thing that I was realizing when I've watched that movie probably 10 times. I love it. You're wonderful in it. I think when I saw you in Portland, I complimented you. I think it's one of the most important things in comedy I've heard in a long time, which is people think that Bill was so great and therefore we should be like Bill. This is the quote that ends the movie. I'm misquoting you horribly, and you're sitting here. So maybe you could say it after I remind you what I'm saying. But you were like, his lesson wasn't be like Bill. His lesson was be yourself.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Because every comedian I've ever met that was like, my influences are hicks. Anyone that said that, I was like, you're going to suck. Mm-hmm. I'm going to hate you. You're going to get up and you're going to rail and you're going to be 24 and I fucking hate you. When Bill started, he was clean. He reminds me of Mulaney. Do you know John Mulaney?
No.
He's just another – he kind of looks like young Bill, just like clean, talking about his family, very polished. And then later when he kind of like woke up to what he was really passionate about, that's when he started that stuff. But so many people are inspired by Bill and then they just start being like, fuck politics or whatever, right. Just garbage shit.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so do you remember the quote that exactly?
That's roughly it, and I don't remember the exact quote, but yeah, the point is that don't be like Bill, be yourself.
Right.
It's like, and that was one of the great things about working with Brian Regan at Cobb's in San Francisco is that the guy who booked it, Tom Sawyer, he said, and we both agreed. He goes, "Why do you know why Brian Regan and Bill Hicks are so similar?" And I said, yeah, because they both have their own voice and they're both true to it. Mm-hmm. And he was like, exactly. He goes, that's why I book these people. I don't book them unless they have their own voice and they're true to themselves. And so that's what
we just don't want to get stuck doing impressions of our heroes or whatever.
Right. Or hiding behind a persona because we're scared to be who we are.
In the weirdest way. Yes.
Which could be, you know, which is something I have to tell myself frequently, is that sometimes I feel like I'm hiding behind a persona.
Brilliant. And thank you for that, because that's exactly – I'm right there with you. Mm-hmm. It's like when I started, it was Brian Regan. every like weird roast we had for someone who didn't have a career to roast, the joke that I would get was that Brian Regan is here or whatever. You know, like something about how I was Regan. And it still comes out. I can't watch him and all that sort of stuff. But like hiding – where are you in that, what you're good at, what you want to say? Is what you want to say in stand-up? Or is it somewhere else, like with Brian, with painting or whatever, or art, whatever? I was assuming it was painting when you said that. Where are you when you're like, are you hiding behind a persona? Are you being the comedian that you want to be, even this late in the game?
Well, you know, like a year ago, I started playing around with a couple of observations I had about animals, and it has grown into 20 minutes about animals, and it's squeaky clean,
mm-hmm.
and it's goofier than hell. But it's classic. This is – I gave myself permission to push and keep doing this goofy animal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become my favorite stuff. And it's become – much of the audience comes up and it's the first thing they quote.
Mm-hmm.
I love your crab impression.
Mm-hmm.
And and I realize that I am not changing anybody's life with doing an impression of a crab.
Right.
But at the same time, I know that I'm being true to my – one aspect of myself, which is when I was a teenager. And
it's funny, in the movie it has home video of you and Bill acting like gorillas.
Yes, yes.
So it's clearly in your blood. Yes, this is what you want to do.
I know. Well, and Bill and I were that way. We were just – it was so goofy.
Yeah.
With a capital G. And we adored that.
Yes.
And it's such a release. I think for guys, it is a release. There's just – for guys when you're hanging around and you're just pals and you're in middle school and high school, being goofy is just so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
That Jim Carrey has a career because of that.
Right. And junior high kids and everybody, but especially junior high kids, will love Jim Carrey because we're trying to be composed. We're just grappling the idea of posture.
Mm-hmm.
My back is supposed to be – and I look at this and I sit in a chair and I talk to a girl and somebody's just like flailing around like a fish. And you're like, oh, that's – I still want to do that. I was doing that a couple years ago, but now I can't. And then you see a grown man do it. It's a wonderful permission.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel extra pressure? Maybe you were putting it on yourself. Because Bill ended up being so, like, you know, political and religious and was saying cutting-edge things, is that the genesis of you being like, I should be saying something more challenging, or?
Not really, because, I mean, that was a, you know, it obviously comes out in your stand-up, just what you're interested in,
mm-hmm.
and making observations and, I mean, like, for example, you know, the state of Washington, Colorado legalized pot. Oregon had a measure to also legalize pot, and it failed. And I just couldn't believe that Oregon, where I live, was out-liberaled by Washington and Colorado. Are you kidding me? Because Oregon has the worst reputation anywhere of being a liberal bastion. They just look upon Oregon as being just these out-of-work slackers going around in vegetable oil cars looking for, you know, hemp tattoos and just shitting piercings. You know, that's our image that we have to endure. And then we get out-liberaled?
Yes, by Washington, D.C.
Right.
Where the president is.
With Washington.
Well, unfortunately, he's a Democrat, but yes.
Yes, and Colorado, out-liberal. So it's like, well, I just feel that Oregon has to liberal up and get back on the liberal game. And so, no, we're not going to have legal pot. We're going to have mandatory pot. I think that's a step in the right direction to get back on the liberal roller coaster. And if you know what? Age 5, you want a half-day kindergarten for your kid, that's fine, but you have to get a shoulder tattoo of a wolf. That's required. The point being is that was on my mind, and yes. I started talking about it and thinking about it on stage. The point being is that I think that I didn't feel obliged to be like Bill.
Yes.
But I just was a natural extension. But at the same time, I am hypersensitive, and this is a problem that I will deal with the rest of my life, is people can't help but make comparisons, and they will no matter what.
Your performance, you mean? Or yes. Just like in stupid things like this, where it's like, ooh, like Bill?
In perform everything. Yeah. Everything. If you're a Bill fan, of which I ran into a couple this weekend, and I can tell already, when I turn around and they're walking toward me and they go, hey, I'm a real big fan, I can look in their eyes and go, you're a fan of Bill.
Yeah.
And you're happy. You saw the documentary and you're happy to see me.
Yes.
And I'm fine with that because Bill is my dearest friend, and I want anything to give people back some connection with them.
Yes.
I'd be happy to. But I do get, you know, it's disappointing that I don't think I will ever be a stand-up without people looking at Bill in my background, mm-hmm. and it'll be a shadow,
mm-hmm.
and that's fine. I've accepted that, and that's fine. But
it's got to be, it's hairy. It feels a little bit weird.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there's a movie out that documents my adolescence. The first quarter of it is about my life.
Yeah.
With this guy.
Yeah.
And I could not be happier. You know, I could not be happier that people know that story.
Yeah.
And because, you know, it didn't take Bill and I long to, when we were living in Burbank, in this tiny studio apartment. We were both enamored by our story. We were like, someone has got to acknowledge the fact that we were 14 riding our bikes with 8x10 photos and trying to get gigs.
And 19 and meeting with William Morris.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a picture of you in that movie holding a picture of Maharishi.
Mm-hmm.
Were you meditating at the time?
Yeah, I started meditating when I was 14.
Really?
And Bill also meditated.
Transcendental
meditation.
How wild. It's not mentioned in the movie. I was so proud of myself. I was like, this is good research. You're just
good
holding a photo of him.
Good for you.
You did it when you were 14?
Yeah. I mean, I talked about Bill and I's spiritual – because Bill was an enormously spiritual guy, and we had a – I mean, that was essentially how –
Even at 14? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Even at 14. One of the biggest times we got into trouble with our parents was that after we were working at Wendy's – Bill and I closed, which means you got done around 12:30 closing the store. And then we were riding our bikes back, and we stopped in the Safeway parking lot, and we were talking about a book on psychic phenomena and about fate and destiny, and how psychic phenomena says that when you're born, you're basically born with a script that you're going to be living. You can deviate and improv with this script, but your destiny and your dharma is set. And we were thrilled by that. And I remember Bill on his bike doing a little circle under the light at Safeway, going, thinking like, it's all been planned. It's all been planned. It's all set up.
Meaning the circles.
Right. No. Meaning the fact that his life was already determined.
I thought he meant even this. I literally thought it.
Well, you know what? We were thinking that at that moment, too. Going, yeah. This moment was planned.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like literally 5 minutes later when his mom came up in the car. What are you guys doing? And evidently, she had called my dad, and my dad was like, yeah, he's working tonight. He goes, well, they're not home. Where are they? And my dad went out looking for me. They were looking for us because we're 15 years old coming home from Wendy's, and we're unaccountable at 1 in the morning.
But
we're not out smoking pot or you know, anything. We're talking about destiny and fate.
Yeah.
And we get in trouble because of it.
Yeah.
We're grounded because we were talking about psychic phenomena. So the point is that Bill and I were graciously mirrors. We were that face that we talked about earlier, face.
The mom face, the crowd face.
Right.
For each other.
And I was a face for him, and he was a face for me about, look, it's okay to talk about these things. It's okay. So, yeah, I meditated, and I still meditate.
Well, how did you find that? I'm 33. I just found it.
Oh, have you started?
Yeah.
Oh, congratulations. That's very exciting.
Do you do it every day?
Every day. I have not missed a day.
220s?
I do. Well, I've done the Siddhi program.
What's that mean?
The TM Siddhi program is a further expansion of what your program is, where you, as you know, when you do transcendental meditation, you settle down and you reach that transcendental state. The TM Siddhi program makes that a little bit active. So when you start to act from that transcendental state, activity becomes more dynamic and more meaningful.
What do you mean act?
Well, you know,
to bring people in on this, so when we say transcendental state, we mean you've been meditating for a while and you kind of come to that Zen calm place.
Well, it's a state that because you use a mantra, and it's a state of no mantra, no thought.
What's
just
your mantra?
Pure awareness. Here it comes. I'm posting it online.
Tweet it.
If you want to know my mantra, text mantra to 857-221.
People are going to do it, Dwight.
Yes.
It's a popular show. Go on. So when you get to that state, you were talking about the activity.
Right. It's pure consciousness. It's a state of restful alertness.
Oh, you were saying you use a mantra.
Right. You use the mantra, and the mantra settles your mind down, and pretty soon there's no mantra, no thought, and you're just awareness. Mm-hmm. It's, Eastern would call it samadhi or whatever, but it's just a very, very... You know, they've done measurements and they found that state of rest is deeper than any deep sleep. Your heart rate, your breathing rate go way, way down. Mm-hmm. So it's just obviously it just creates more dynamic activity through. But the Siddhi program takes that deep state and just introduces a few techniques to make it active. You know, what would happen if you thought from that state, that pure consciousness, the thought would become more powerful?
You mean, you know, it's interesting. I try and do that sort of stuff. But I was just improvising. Meaning, are you giving yourself suggestions in that thought? Is that what you mean?
No. It's a very specific technique. That's the brilliance.
Oh, I don't want to make you give it away.
No. I couldn't.
Yeah.
Maharishi has structured this information. That's what his brilliance was he took very, very deep traditional ancient wisdom from the East and brought it and made it palatable for the Western person who can go out and enjoy activity but also come home at night and transcend and then and enjoy life afterwards. So,
right.
So Bill and I were initiated at the same time.
How was it introduced to the two of you?
My brother, Kevin, who was 10 years older than me, he went out he went to college in Austin, Texas. And he left this very straight-laced guy and came back 9 months later with a beard, long hair. He was vegetarian. He was juicing his own food. And I was so impressed. I was like, this is in the 70s. And I was like, wow, I want to be and do everything you are. It's the coolest person I've ever seen. And he was bright and he was smiling and he was so full of energy. And he goes, well, that's because I started doing TM and you need to do it too. So I didn't even question it. I just
And did
it.
He teach it to you or did you do the program?
No, you go in and a teacher teaches
so
you.
So someone in your town, Texas?
In Houston. We went to the Houston TM Center and a guy instructed Bill and I. And you just go through the system of teaching and it's great. Good stuff.
And then so when I say 220s, most people or a lot of people that start out do it twice a day for 20 minutes.
Right.
And I believe that's probably what you did at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing now?
I do the TM program, and then I do the TM City program immediately afterwards, and it's a longer program.
Oh, so you're doing it – you're doing the 20 – you didn't lose the 20.
No.
You just do that, and then you continue.
Right.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Can I run this by you?
Shoot.
I now just – I don't know if I should be embarrassed by this. I don't do it twice a day. I do it once a day for about an hour. Is that bad?
I think if you're comfortable with it, then you're comfortable with it. And the benefit of doing it twice a day is you get that cyclical, you know, the evening activity becomes as dynamic as the morning. But you know, you just you make your own decision about it, whatever you feel comfortable with. But yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
I'm learning more and more even after doing it for literally almost 30 years.
Wow.
That
you haven't missed a day in 30 years?
I have missed days, but...
But you haven't missed a day recently?
No. And you can always do it. You can do it on the plane. You can do it in a taxi cab, even if it's just, you know, 5 minutes.
Yeah. Well, you must have that thing now that my teacher, Lynn, told me about. She was like, if you... Once you've been doing it a while, and I've only been doing it maybe a year, you can kind of get to that place kind of quickly. Without the mantra or anything, you can kind of find that gear in your brain. Mm-hmm. Do you find that?
Mm-hmm.
There's like a lower gear you throw into?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the benefit of doing it regularly. And what I've determined is at the same time every day. If you can do it at the same time every day, which is hard when you travel, but that regularity makes you be able to transcend and experience that pure consciousness faster.
You really?
Faster.
Like your body,
right.
The internal clock knows it's 3 o'clock or whatever.
Right.
And it's time to do it.
As soon as you close the eyes and you sit down, your body goes, oh, I know what's happening here.
Uh-huh.
And the mantra just takes you very naturally there.
Do you even really use your mantra much? Is it at the beginning, I have to imagine you just feel like you're repeating your mantra over and over and over. As I've progressed now, it's there and then it goes away faster.
Mm-hmm.
You've been doing it so long. Is it a couple times and you're there?
Well, you know, oddly enough, I suffer from a lot of thoughts. Thoughts come, but the clock will go by, and I won't be aware of the time, and the time suddenly is gone, and it's like I don't know where I was.
Yeah,
but I'm happier, and things are good, and there's a balance to it. So.
That's great. Have you, you know, when I set out to do it, it was because one of my questions for you that I have always wanted to ask you just in life, and here we are just talking on the show, is did you ever do mushrooms with Bill?
I never did mushrooms with Bill, no.
Have you ever done mushrooms?
Yeah, I did them. I've done them twice, but only once that where it was.
Did I ask you that in Portland? That sounds familiar all of a sudden.
Could be. I went to Stanhope's party in the desert in 06 or 07,
uh-huh.
And it just seemed appropriate.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And anyway.
Did you enjoy it? So I talked to my teacher. And she was like, they give you the spiel, and they're like, this is about stress and stress management and energy. And then we go in the private room where they give you their mantra and all that sort of stuff. And I was like, I'm not here for stress. I want that stuff that you and Bill were talking about. I want to think about Dharma and destiny, and I want to think about consciousness, and I want to what is it? Cosmic consciousness, all that sort of stuff.
Beautiful.
I don't care. I'm not stressed. I'm not stressed out. Have you ever, through meditation, or maybe it's private, you don't have to answer any question I ask you, had experiences that are similar to mushrooms that feel spiritual?
What mushrooms do, I think, is they you know, open a little window, and you look through the window, and you get experience from it. But then you come back to who you are. Mm-hmm. What I find with TM is that you have the experience and it stays with you. So in other words, you experience this really, really lovely state of peace and with no mantra, no thought, a place of pure, you know, pure consciousness, and it comes out with you. And that's the benefit. I think with mushrooms, I noticed I was shut down for 3 or 4 days. It's a hard experience. You go through it, and then you wake up, and you're like,
yeah, there is an exhaustion for a couple of days afterwards.
And but you know, experiencing a lot on mushrooms sort of gives you, you know, changes your perception and makes you interested and open to other things and other ideas. Mm-hmm. And I cannot. I was very happy with my experience, and
you did have fun. It was a positive.
Yeah, point. I remember I was sitting with Augie Smith, another comedian, and we were tripping, and there was a folk singer at this shindig, and she was walking through the trees, and she had this scarf on, and it was an orange scarf, and it was flowing in the wind behind her, and it was like, and Augie and I was like, do you see that? And go, I see it too, and he's like, I think it's real. And it was just a beautiful sight that we called her over and said, look, we're tripping. Would you mind playing us some songs? And she goes, I would love to. So she started playing songs, and I go, and I was looking at her, and I go, this is going to sound weird, but can I put my head in between your legs and just lean back and listen to the music. And she was like, okay.
Oh.
And so I just leaned back into her vagina. And just my head had that feminine energy to it, and she started playing, and it was just so spectacular.
That sounds incredible.
Yes, I know.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Because when I have tripped, I have seen femininity. That's the primary experience I have on mushrooms, or the only experience I've had on mushrooms, is that I see pink, and I see crevices. Everything in nature looks like, you know, the V of the vagina. There's all, you know, there's the, anyway, I don't know why that is.
No, don't bag away from this. I couldn't be more interested. I just, you know, I love that. Didn't we just talk about this on the show? I think I have a feminine energy. Did we talk about that on the show? Mm-hmm. I guess as a man, I'm supposed to be ashamed of that. Not that that's why I think you were laughing, Katie, but in my regular Western brain, I'm like, oh, I should be ashamed of that. But I love connecting, and I love my mother. Like, I was always more close to girls. And when I hear you say that, I wonder if that's another reason why you and I hit it off so quickly, because that sounds like something that I would see. And that fantasy is exactly what I'm talking about. One time I took mushrooms, God, fuck it, Pete. Nobody thinks you're trying to one-up his story. I've almost censored myself. I took mushrooms, and I was in Big Bear. And I was renting this cabin, and there was a hot tub. And I got a cabin with a hot tub specifically so I could get in the hot tub while I was
there. Were you alone?
No, I was with my girlfriend at the time.
Okay.
And, you know, I kind of almost wish I were alone. The girl was fine, but she was looking at it more as a recreational giggly drug. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I have to pick up the God phone. Excuse me.
All right, yes.
So I got in the hot tub, and I was naked, and it was warm. And I closed my eyes, and I couldn't hear anything because the jets were on. Mm. And I felt like a fetus. I think I felt exactly like a fetus. And you laying on Guitar Lady or Orange Scarf also feels kind of birthy to me. Mm-hmm. Also feels something safe, womb-y, you know, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That maybe this drug is drawing us to that idea. Mm-hmm. There is something spiritual and beautiful of coming out of woman. You know what I mean? I don't know where I was going with that, but that is what I was saying.
And I think that what I took away from that story for me, what I took away from it was that when you tell the truth, which was the truth is I want to sit with my head in between your legs.
Yeah.
And it was so honest, and so I was apologetic about it, and I was guileless. But I think when you speak with the truth and honesty, it changes your direction.
Yes.
And I think for her, she was like, okay, and I'm into this.
She like honored it, actually.
Yes, honored it.
That's I think a that's a word. Beautiful thing.
That's a good word.
Because you were in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the moments in sobriety, something that I work with my therapist in, is dealing with things in real time. Telling somebody what you want in real time instead of politicking or conniving or somehow manipulating someone or slowly revealing what it is you want. I was actually just thinking of something really embarrassing, hugely embarrassing, with my ex-wife, and it was something like she had no idea what I wanted sexually because I never told her. I never told her.
Sure.
Like, I'm hearing what
I'm
saying.
Don't beat yourself up. People die all over the world never saying
exactly
or connecting with their sexuality. It's just, you know.
Or a million different things, or how they feel about their children or their parents or whatever. And that is a wonderful thing to wake up to, that you would like to lay your head on the guitar woman's thing, or you'd like to – this is something that turns you on with your wife. It's in the same area.
Mm-hmm.
But I kept that to myself. And I had no vocabulary because my relationship with my ex was very sweet and sex just didn't really have much of a place there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always like, I'm your sweet little husband guy and you're my precious angel sort of thing. It's hard to fuck an angel. It's hard to be rough with an angel.
Well, I have a tape I'd like to show you.
Angel Blasters 4. Can I bring up something weird? You're also divorced.
Yes.
Which is weird because, you, like I mentioned at the beginning, you knew me when I was married. Mm-hmm. And then when you were doing Zanies in Chicago, mm-hmm. I came and visited you in that weird condo.
Mm-hmm.
And we had another one of those wonderful discussions. And you told me something, and 100%, I don't think this is that weird.
What's funny is that you remember the conversation. I just remember the food. We went out for 3 racks of ribs.
I remember that. Yes. Yeah.
And I love the fact that we were going to each get a rack, and you looked at me and went, we should get a third. And I was like, absolutely. In case the full rack was not enough.
How much of our hanging has been excess, excess foods.
It's very true.
And we went to that pipe shop in Old Town.
Oh, yes.
And I remember being very happy because I was like, oh, I'll take Dwight likes smoking pipes.
Oh, my God.
And you're still into it?
Oh, this is such a wonderful thing.
I want you to help me like it more. Every time I do it, it just tastes like burning. It does. I need help.
Could be, yes.
But I took you to that pipe shop, and you were like, this is the best pipe selection I've ever seen. And I was like, oh, that made me so happy. Then we go into that weird condo. And what I was going to say was, we don't have to talk about anything you don't want to talk about, because this is a sad thing I remember. You were talking about, and I was married at the time. And here I am looking at a man who's, you were about to become divorced, I believe.
Probably, or if it was 06, then yeah, then that's fine. 07, we were divorced. So, and if it was 07 or 08, then yes, then I had just gotten divorced.
2004. It must have been 2004.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay. Okay. Well, yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. Well, we got divorced in 2004. It was finalized in 05. See, I don't even remember. It's just, it was such a non. I mean, it's never fun, but with my ex and I, it was sort of us looking at each other. And the simile I always use is that it's like looking out in the backyard and you have this incredibly cool classic car that used to be such a showpiece. And you said to yourself, we're going to restore this one day and we're going to be so happy in this cool car and we're going to take it in parades and we're going to go on Sundays. And you look in the backyard and you see it's weeds and rust and you look at each other and go, we don't have the time. We don't have the money. Mm. We don't have the energy to restore this beautiful thing. So let's just let it go. And that's sort of what it was with my ex and I. Is there was not a lot of animosity. It was just sort of like, let's let this thing go and do a positive job of it. And so I'm very fortunate that the divorce was a non-event. I don't even remember what it was.
It
just sort of happened.
Right.
And so.
The thing that I remember that was very, I think, the reason I remember was it seemed very kind of good of you and also very heartbreaking. This is what I'm going to tell you that I'm like, if you don't want to talk about it, we don't have to. Is I remember you telling me that you could see, you diagnosed the car as rusty.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember you said to your wife at the time, you were like, we need to have sex. And I know we don't want to, but you just need to let me have sex with you because that will get a little bit of the rust off. And I remember that was your last. Isn't that heartbreaking? I know you said it, but isn't
did
it?
Did I
kind
really?
Of, yeah.
I have no recollection.
I'll never.
Or no desire.
to remember this?
No desire. I mean, I can, you know, I can understand that, though. I can understand where it's like.
She didn't go for it.
No, and I don't blame her. Is that I wouldn't want to have sex with her. Well, what it is the foundation of the house is never the most glamorous part of the house, but without it, the house doesn't stand. And that's what sex is that sex is the foundation. It's very simple, very primal, but if you don't pay attention to it, and if you don't monitor it, and you don't take care of it, the whole house is going to crumble, no matter how nice the house is.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think, the point I was trying to make was like, let's just start
fucking. See if we can work on the foundation.
Yeah. And get the foundation right.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that my marriage also fell apart. And, inadvertently, I just kind of confessed that we weren't having the sex that now I know is possible.
I can only imagine what that was. You mean you can open your eyes doing it? No idea. I can face her? There's no sobbing in the bathroom afterwards?
I like that in my Christian, repressed, no vocab, sweet sex, we're only doing doggy.
Right.
Like, and then when I open up, I'm like, turn around! Let's get nasty! Oh, God. Well, that's very... I'm glad to hear that it was not huge friction.
No.
That it wasn't like, go fuck yourself. And it worked out with the kids?
It worked out, you know.
How old were they when you split?
I think 11 and 10 and 13, I think, something like that. And so, you know, again, it's never good, but I feel fortunate that it was not horribly bad. There was no contentiousness, no yelling. It was just
what
just happened.
Here's a question that I hate, and I'm going to ask you it.
Shoot.
Because when I got divorced, people, you know, a lot of people, and this, I'm speaking for me, please don't think this is generalization, I'm talking to people listening. A lot of people that I believe that never followed their dreams and are in a cold gray line would ask me, or worse, assume that my divorce was because of comedy. To which I say, not really. But also, as I get some distance from it, I'm like, it was a factor. My and I've said this on the show many times, but my ex thought that I had found my true love, which was comedy. Mm. And then she didn't want to be in a three-way. I've often joked, I'm like, anybody with a comedian, you have to be bi for comedy.
Sure.
Because we're all going to fuck together in a big old bed.
Yeah.
And I hope you like comedy.
Yeah.
And if you do, great, because we're going to be weird swingers with this third thing.
Mm-hmm.
My wife didn't want to swing with that. Did your career pursuits, the travel and the introspection, and if you're anything like me, the mood swings? I just told you, I'm in an up place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in an up place. And then other times I'm in a down place, you know what I mean? Where I'm not writing and I'm not performing. Like, did that inform the decay of your relationship?
Well, to my ex's credit, she was all in. She was all in, and she wanted to have the three-way, and that she did everything she could to be part of it. And we were. I mean, for 4 years, we toured the nation in an RV, and I did road gigs and raised our child for 4 years, and never was away from there. I mean, rarely did I go anywhere without my house towing behind me,
yes,
and my spouse and my daughter with me.
4 years.
4 years I did that.
It's nothing to sneeze at.
Right. And so she was in, and I think about what she went through during that 4 years, and it's just horrible. I can't imagine how awful her life was.
Yeah.
And so to her credit, she was in. She wanted to do it. And it's probably pretty glamorous for someone in their 20s. It's like pretty fun, you know. You head out on the road and whatever. So I don't know. I don't know how she feels about it, but I think she's like she has a good sense of humor now about it and whatnot. But you know, and I'm not sure exactly where this went, but
It sounds like that to me.
Well, comedy being the reason you got divorced,
yeah,
and I think absolutely, it has something to do with it.
Yeah,
it's just
you know, after the
part of who you are.
Of course, it's a huge part, isn't it? Weird,
yes.
This weird. Clan that we belong to. Mm-hmm. It is in our blood, and it is to go back to circles in the parking lot, it feels like dharma. You'll never catch more people using the D word, destiny, than when things sorry, I was eating a quesadilla. Things are going in the direction that you always thought they would. That's when a lot of people will start throwing around these kind of Eastern ideas of the script being written and being like, well, that's where you belong. Dwight, you're happier and you're talking about your career in a high gear. That's because that's where you belong. You found your like groove and all that sort of stuff. I don't know where I was going with that. Where do you feel – how are you now? Are you on your bike doing circles? Do you believe in that idea of predestination?
I'm in a really good place now, because the thing about divorce for me, after raising two kids and, you know, being totally devoted to fatherhood and trying to manage a comedy career and putting my ex through medical school at the time, is that when the divorce happened, I was just so happy to be by myself again. And when I found myself alone in my goddamn house, from here to the sidewalk, my land, stay off, is that I felt this this reacquainting with, oh, I remember this guy.
Uh-huh.
I remember him.
Yeah.
He was like this, you know, he'd talk to himself and come up with characters and could wander around the house and be weird and it was such a great experience.
And have 20 minutes on Animal.
Right. Exactly.
Yes.
Yes.
Do a crab impression.
Yes. Yes. I was thrilled. And it was and that experience really got me through a lot in the past few years. And now I'm sort of like knocking on the door of another chapter in my life where I've met someone and I've just fallen hopelessly in love with her. And it sucks because I'm vulnerable and whatever. But I feel like something's coming.
Yeah.
And I feel better. Feel great.
That's great. You should call the 80s mystic and see what's going to happen.
Yeah, don't think
I'm so happy to hear that, Dwight, because here's my current dilemma. I was relationship-y, marriage. one-year relationship. Now I've been single for a couple of years, and I love it. I don't have any land, but if I did, I would be like, this is mine. I do have my apartment.
It's great.
I told you about the Post-its.
Mm-hmm.
That right there is a little bit of an indication. I live alone.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's notes on the walls, and I love it. And I love the worst thing that a relationship can do, I think you'll agree, or one of the worst things, is it turns you into somebody else.
Yeah.
You're like, when did I become this person?
Yeah.
And that reacquaintance with yourself, and then that embracing of solitude, not being codependent, but being self-reliant,
right. Right.
and going, I'm the king of this goddamn castle, not mm-hmm. just your house, but your spirit, your body, mm-hmm. and everything. That's when I got all my shit together. I got a lot of my shit together, career-wise, physically, spiritually. That's why I'm taking TM and all this sort of stuff. Because sometimes relationship Pete doesn't know how to prioritize and give himself time because I want to be liked so badly and I want to be the perfect boyfriend so badly. I'll forfeit every value to just be whoever I think I'm supposed to be for this person. Now, here's the thing that I love is that you're telling me that you were where I am. This land is mine.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck off. One shotgun cock in the dark and everything that's a threat to you runs. And now you fell in love, you son of a bitch. That's great news.
I hope it is.
I hope it is, too.
Because as you were speaking, I was thinking to myself, oh, my God, I'm relationship Pete. I've turned into Pete Holmes relationship guy. Where are my Post-its?
You can have them. Just explain. Say, this is who I am, baby. Get them up before you move in together. But I'm happy. It does me well because I love you and I want you to have love and I want your heart to be open to that. Right?
Yes.
And you're saying, look, let's not put too much pressure on this, but it's nice that you're even open to it.
Sure.
Because I don't want bitterness. I don't want to have a hard heart. I'm not the Pharaoh. Let my people go. Here they are. Here you go. Weird biblical reference. So how did you meet this person? Do you want to talk about that?
It was at a show. It was sort of glamorous in the fact that she was sitting in the front row and that I went after her.
Flirting from stage?
Not even flirting. No, I went after her more brutally than I've ever been after any human being from stage. Ever.
You mean after not like roasting her. You mean you were saying,
No, roasting her.
Really?
Brutal.
Oh, you mean going after.
Yeah, going after, digging, being brutally, some would say mean.
What, do you remember anything he said?
Yeah, at one point I was just constantly hammering on her, and I remember thinking at the time that I had to do this, that it was necessary for me, and that I was not going to let up.
Yeah.
I was going to go as far as it got to where it was getting laughs, and it was killing.
Yeah, what club?
It was Sun Valley Resort in Sun Valley, Idaho.
Okay,
it was,
Idaho.
So, yeah,
from the beginning of the show. Yes,
I know it all comes towards the full circle, doesn't it? Yes.
Let's meditate.
So,
what did you say? What were some of
the- I think that the pinnacle was that she went up to go to the bathroom at some point, and another guy from part of the room was also going to the bathroom. And I said, you know, she's in there blowing this guy right now. How can you tolerate being sitting with a woman who would blow a guy in a club right now?
What started it?
I don't know. I don't know. I just know that I was brutally going after her. I mean, of roasting her and engaging her. And then when she walked out of the bathroom, I was like, here she is. And I was wiping my mouth as if she was wiping. And the crowd was loving it. And so I didn't stop. And then after the show, she goes, I think you owe me a drink. And I said, I think you owe me a drink because I made you the center of attention. And I go, where are you going to take me to drink? And
you was, dick.
Yes, I know.
You're a magical dick. You're the king of the dick.
Yes, it's so
I mean
true.
That in the best way. One of those moments, I don't think it's a coincidence that you just got off stage. You're feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
You're true self. You're your powerful self. And a woman, a beautiful woman comes up and says, you owe me a drink. And you do.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, no, you owe me a
That's
drink.
That's right.
This is a great meeting story.
It's true. And what I realized after a year, I don't know if I've ever told her this, but I realized that she was at a point in her life she needed a man, in my opinion,
yes.
that was willing to do that, because she was sort of in a weird place in her life with possibly too much partying and possibly getting away from her center and her truth and who she was really was. And she needed a man to absolutely blast through that. I had to get her attention. And we've commented that it's as similar as pulling someone's hair on the playground, except I not only pulled it, I took off her entire scalp. So,
but that decisiveness, that sort of like that, it's funny talking about feminine energy and stuff, but I also do pride myself in my better moments of being a decisive person, and that is an attractive quality. Mm-hmm. And that exchange right there with like, no, you're going to get me a drink. There's something very attractive, I think, to women and in general, where you can be like, and if somebody is coming from a hard place, and maybe if it is like you said, too much partying or something, somebody that's solid. Somebody that's like, no, this is what we're doing. Like, follow me. Sort of like a little bit of an alpha role.
Sure.
The dick does the fucking.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, I don't know. Well, I think that should be the name of the podcast. This particular one, The Dick Does the Fucking with Dwight Slade.
Dwight Slade. Welcome back to The Dick Does the Fucking. Well, The Dick Does the Fucking. And there is something beautiful about going back to that, if that works for these two people, to go back to that dynamic and be like, I'll be the dick and I'll do the fucking, and you'll be the vagina and you'll enjoy the fucking, and you'll be the beautiful vessel of life and hope and everything beautiful. I'm not diminishing women, but it is nice to kind of know the place. So where did you go to get a drink?
There at Sun Valley, we went to...
you just started making out right there.
I know. Well, she probably would have been happy with that. No, I'm not. Just a bar in the lodge. It was actually very... the lodge there has been there since the 20s. It's a beautiful lodge in Sun Valley. It's where Hemingway hung out.
Yes.
He hung out at the bars there. And then later killed himself because, well, it was Idaho. Anyway, so it's a very romantic place to be. So
yeah, so you just the two of you went to get a drink,
and a collection of her friends and stuff like that. And I think she says that she knew that there was a connection when, again, the dick does the fucking. I reached over and started eating stuff off her plate.
The dick does the fucking,
right? And I helped myself. I didn't ask. I just started taking her.
That's Eternal Sunshine.
Is it?
Do you've seen that?
I have.
When they meet, when Clementine and Joel meet, he's eating chicken, and she reaches over and takes the chicken from him. And she was kind of the alpha energy in that relationship.
I auditioned for that movie.
Did you?
For a part in it, yeah.
That's great. You would have been a great Joel Barish.
I would have been happy. I auditioned for the part. It was Elijah Wood, I think, played it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Like, I can't imagine why they didn't get an unknown comic from Oregon to play the part when they had Elijah Wood to do it.
You're not creepy enough. Well, yes. Maybe you could be it. I believe, you know, we pinch fire truck, you could do it. But he says in the movie, he goes, like, she says, can I have some of your chicken? And then you reached over and just took it like we were already lovers.
Mm.
And I think that line is beautiful because that is dick does the fucking, even though she's the dick in that situation. But she was doing the fucking. And that can be pleasant for a man as well. Go, like somebody knowing what they want. I've been drawn to women that are like, fuck that, we're going here. No. You know what I mean? That gets old a little bit. It probably gets old for everybody. But I'm very happy that you're not jaded or dark about this topic.
No, I'm not jaded. I'm terrified, but I'm not jaded.
I love that. It's good to be scared, right? It's good to feel something, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. And I'm very grateful for that. I've never had feelings like this ever.
Yes.
And so I'm you know, willing to go forward. I'm just damn the torpedoes.
How do we get to Portland? Did she move to Portland?
She has not. No, we're still doing a long distance thing and so it's, you know, that's the murky part.
Yeah. So. Although I would submit, I've talked to a couple fellas, and I've been in a long distance myself, that sometimes that's kind of the greatest thing in the world.
People tell me that, yeah.
You have the time to miss each other,
mm-hmm.
and then you have the time to reunite.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you're constantly just stretching the rubber band and then snapping it and stretching it and snapping it and stretching it, instead of just like, you again.
You were here yesterday.
One of my favorite lines of you, speaking of your darkness, is one of my favorite lines of yours is people are always saying you don't look as old as you are, or you don't look your age, is a way to say that. And you say, don't count birthdays.
Count the dark angels.
In your eyes.
Yes.
Yes. I love that line so, so much. Such a great thing. Where are you? Let's go back to the spiritual stuff because I'm just so jazzed.
Well, I'm thrilled, man, that you're doing TM. It's really a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear
and
that.
And a little bit ironic because it was 2 weeks ago that I got also in the TM movement. There's advanced techniques.
Yes.
Which are different from the City program. which are small techniques that add to your meditation. We're part of the 20-minute part.
Uh-huh.
And I got my, quote, final one two weeks ago, and it has been just – well, it's been sort of a blessing. It's a pretty intense experience, and I've had roughness outside of meditation because it's pretty dramatic.
Really?
But anyway, so –
so a new technique was introduced, and it's fucking your shit up?
Well, you know, when you go through six, there's six advanced techniques, and
can you give me a because if I'm doing TM and I don't understand what you mean, people who don't do TM have no idea what you're talking about. Is it you're repeating a mantra, and now you have a new technique?
Right.
Is that another word?
Well, it's and Maharishi makes a big distinction about their techniques, which means they're very minor. They're just techniques. They aren't profound or dramatic.
Sure. None of it really is.
It's right.
It's all very. But is it?
And so there's simple techniques, and it just adds to your 20-minute meditation. So the mantra may change a little bit. The change in the mantra changes the quality of the meditation. Makes the experience broader.
Okay.
So instead of just hitting that no mantra, no thought, then you're expanding it as if it goes from being a 1-inch hole down to the transcendent to a 1-foot hole.
Yeah.
So more of it comes out. Well, so these are just small techniques, little tweaking, so to speak.
But it's in your mind.
So it's just part of your program.
It's not necessarily like hold your nose.
No. So, but
I've been holding my nose twice.
Oh, good God! For an hour? Jesus! Get a post-it.
I rarely do it an hour. I allow an hour. That way, I can end I feel like it's over.
Oh, okay.
As opposed to being like I gotta go. When I know I have 20 minutes and then I have to leave right when I'm done, I don't like that.
Yeah,
it freaks me out. But I'll tell you, for comedians listening, meditation, now when I go on the road and I'm like, I have nothing to do today, you can get some really good me time in there. It is beautiful. It's wonderful. How are you spiritually? I'm very interested in the idea that even at 14, you were not religious, but your parents were religious?
Well, they thankfully, they were both kind of intellectual and so they had a healthy cynicism. We went to church as kids and then just slowly went away. I think my parents were kind of like, let's stop this.
What
this
kind of church?
Lutheran.
Okay.
And it's funny that you should mention that because I was thinking of this the other day, is that when I was 9, I was coming out of church and they had a table set up about a prayer partnership program. And I'm 9 years old. And I went over and I go, what's this? And they said, well, this is we have a group of people, and you can pray for people in other countries that are suffering. Uh-huh. And I went, I'll do that. I mean, this is a 9-year just – you could not be more angelic than this.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were like a kid up here, you know.
Yeah.
So I signed up for it, and I went home, and I was praying for these people. At 9 years old, I had no idea what I was praying for. Yeah. I was just praying for people in, I think, Africa that were – suffering. And there was this kind of feeling like, well, why aren't I praying for, you know, my own family? Or I don't even pray for my own family. So I was feeling guilty. I was like, here I am praying for suffering people, but I'm also guilty that I'm not praying for my own family. So I'm like, well, I'll pray for my own family also. And here I am. I'm like got a list. I'm praying for 5 minutes. I'm praying every day. And I'm like, it's a lot to do.
It's a burden.
Yes. And then out of the blue, I start getting correspondences every 2 weeks that look like invoices. And they were asking for donations for the program. And my mom was like, why is my child getting invoices? So she would open them up and she's like, well, they asked for a donation. They would come every 2 weeks asking for donations. And I would suddenly realize that I go, oh, they want money for their program. They don't want my prayers. And it was this real betrayal.
Uh-huh.
I felt so betrayed that it was not about me praying. And that was a break from Christianity. That was all it took.
At nine.
And I trust that because a 9-year-old didn't lie to themselves. And I was guilty. I felt miserable about it, that I had been taken advantage of and I felt used by the church. And oftentimes the church does use you. Does use your feeling and your sense of obligation and your guilt, and they use it to control you. And I'm 9 years old, and I figured that out. And so I knew that I was never going to be a church guy, even then. And I feel totally good about that because I was so young and I knew it.
Yeah, there is a purity to that revelation.
Yeah.
You weren't some jaded teenager.
And I would say that to someone who is religious, to go, look, if a 9-year-old can figure out the bullshit in this, then you got problems. And you need to sort your house out.
Isn't that a biblical reference?
It's in Deuteronomy, I think.
Oh, deep cut. So from then, take me from 9, your parents were cool with you being like, this is bullshit.
And then that's kind of, you know, then we just stop going every week, and there was never any mention of it. But then my brother came back.
Your
brother.
Your fucking John the Baptist brother.
Yes.
Comes
came
with
back,
the robe and the beard.
Juicing carrots, and he's just so freaking awesome. Like, he's got posters of Grand Funk Railroad in his room, and it's just like, wow.
Yes.
Everything I ever wanted was here. So
I love that. I love that relationship with your. I envy that relationship. The envy of your brother. Your brother being like a hero type character,
totally, yeah.
And then he tells you about meditation.
Yes.
And I guess we can fast forward. Your choice. You can take me through it, or fast forward to now. Where are you spiritually? What's going on? What is this? Are we a dream?
Well, you know, oddly enough, it starts coming full circle, is that it never changes. There's a simplicity to it, and I realize I just do my program. And I don't try to get something from it. I don't expect anything from it. I just do it.
But apart from meditation, though, what do you think this is all about?
Good question. I think, you know, like anybody, I just think it's a journey, and that and what I have to remind myself is within that journey there are magical unexplained moments, and that those are really valuable, and not to try to control outcomes, but just enjoy them and let them wash over you.
Right. That sounds like presence to me. You're trying to be present and not to control your future.
Yes, exactly.
Just take it as it comes.
Exactly.
Do we have is there some sort of God guy?
I think if you've read The Power of Now and Eckhart Tolle's
currently reading it, actually,
yeah, pretty powerful stuff. His real genius.
It's taking me forever.
Yes,
like I read a page and I'm like, I'm going to drink a bottle of whiskey or something. I don't know. I just need to process that. Go on.
Yeah. Well, what I recommend is I listen to the book tape, which he reads.
Ah.
And it's much more palatable because he's so good at it.
I love that. I'm writing that down.
But the idea, he makes good use of the word presence. He really identifies the fact that words have a lot of baggage with them. And one thing he says is that the word God has a lot of baggage.
Well, that's when I said God gave me two hands, I got two coffees. Like, I was like, I don't want Dwight to think that I mean something simple by that.
Right. And that, yeah. And that you're not a guy who's like, you know, going next door to the Christian youth group. And
yes.
Not that you wouldn't.
When you met me, I was. Or I was just coming out of that.
Okay.
But now I'm in that messy place where God... Mm-hmm. Is a complete mess. It's a complete mess. I don't have them in a bottle anymore.
Right.
Or her. I always make fun of people that get hung up on the gender of this inexplicable thing. But maybe they have a point. I shouldn't be. But you know, the dick does the fucking. God's dick does the fucking. Anyway, although it might make more sense that it's a woman because we're laying down in her lap with the guitar. Oh God, I just had a revelation. I'm kidding. So please don't let me stop you. Presence and Eckhart and what's it all about? It's a journey, and I was asking what God means to you.
Right. Well, I think Eckhart does a good job in saying that let's not talk too much about the word God and get boggled down, but just find words that point. And then he talks about experience, is that I can sit here and describe a strawberry to you up and down all day, but until you eat the strawberry.
Yeah. Well, that's the TM thing.
That is the TM thing. So I think that your experience with what God is always changing, and that eventually you have to experience it.
Right.
And that's what true faith is, because faith and delusion have a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
I think people who are deluded often call themselves faithful. And I disagree. I think you're delusional. But I think I have a great sense of faith because I have a concrete experience of what I have, and I don't proselytize it. I just feel faithful toward what happened to me and the experience I've had. So.
Right. And in that, are there specific things that come to mind? Do you have touchstones that are like, you're like, this is the anatomy of my spirituality?
This is what it is that if I sit down and I close my eyes and I say, Almighty Father, I feel like I'm in the presence of something. Hmm. And that presence is a very, very, I don't know if it's quote, God,
yeah,
or just someone who's interested in me, or it's maybe it's me. on some huge higher self, higher power.
Yeah.
I just know that when I say that, I close my eyes and I say, Almighty Father, and I'm sitting there, I feel like I connect with this entity, and the entity is all compassionate and all forgiving and just says, what is your fucking problem? Just tell me what your problem is. And I just feel this, you know, I dump it on his lap, and his lap says, do you see how silly it all is? And you're like, yes, I do see it now.
Yeah.
And coming out of that experience I feel pretty faithful about that experience.
Hmm. It sounds like you're open to the idea of this other entity. You're also open to the idea that it's just another interpretation of yourself.
Sure. I don't know.
I love that.
And there's a mystery to it, and I'm happy with the mystery. The mystery is what brings you to your knees.
Yeah.
The mystery is, you know, when you're on a fall day and you see a swirl of leaves, or you see those that pack of sparrows that all move at one time, you know, and you just drop to your knees and go, oh, fuck, I don't know the answers.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very valuable moment for seekers and people who are looking for something more in life.
Yeah. Do you vibe with that, some of those ideas that Bill said in his stand-up about, you know, all matter is just...
It's a beautiful... The way he configures it is a beautiful...
It resonates with me when I hear him say it.
He does such a good job with that. He just... And what I knew about Bill Hicks was that, say that in case people don't remember, was at times
I'm saying Bill like he's my friend. With Bill.
He's everyone's friend.
That's one of my things when they do like an intervention. They'll go like let's say we're intervening for your brother who's addicted to Xanax. And then he'll go like, and it sounds to me like mom also has a problem. Like he'll say mom. It's the same thing at a funeral. It's like, or a wedding. They'll go, mom, would you like to say? It's like, motherfucker, that's not your mom. And I'm like, Bill. Anyway, so Bill put it perfectly, or put a lot of things that resonated with you.
Well, at times I stayed with him and hung out with him. I stayed with him in New York, and you know, we lived together in Burbank for many years. And then I visited him here in LA when he moved to LA. And the times that I was with him, he wrote very little down. And he was a guy who was organic and wrote on stage, and he was devoted to – he knew that stage time was the way that he was going to develop, and so that's why he booked the shit out of himself.
Yes.
And was such a road dog for so many years.
That's what makes me so sad. Keep going, though.
Is that – yeah, and it is kind of sad, because when I visited him after, you know, he was – you know, he played that sold-out concert at the Dominion in London, where 3,500 people were staring at him, and they were all going Bill. He was a one word celebrity in the UK.
Yes.
If you said Bill on the street, people would go Bill Hicks.
Yeah.
He came home from that, and I was staying with him, and he had this two bedroom apartment in off of Pico, and there was no furniture. There was no couch. It was just a mattress where he had video games and the TV set up, and then in his room he had a futon laying on the floor. He had a beautiful Jeep that he had bought, but he didn't have any possessions. It was all about his stand-up and his life on the road, and he didn't have a relationship at the time that was and so in other words, you know, talk about a guy who was so devoted, but the point being is that he was so devoted toward developing his craft that he had to have stage time because he wrote so little down. I mean, I remember seeing notebooks, and he had literally, it was like next Letterman, and he had a set list of like five things.
Yeah.
And that was it on the page. but I think that the quote that you're quoting there, it was
energy.
So beautiful.
Yeah.
Is something he took time to really clarify it.
Oh, do you remember it?
I don't know. I didn't watch American. No.
It was just, all energy is just matter slowed down to a specific vibration. All matter is energy slowed down to different vibrations. And it's something like, and we are all God. Death is, there's no such thing as death. Life is a dream. And we're just all the same consciousness going, imagining itself. But when I hear that sort of, those mushroomy ideas of we're all connected, when you talk about Almighty Father moving, every time you said it moved me, I can't tell if that's the biology of how I came up. Certain things like Jesus makes me feel something.
Sure.
Almighty Father makes me feel something. But like when people are like, we're all the same thing, this there is no separation between me and you. And there's no separation between me and Katie or me and this table and life and trees and all. And that's another thing they thought when they were on mushrooms was that time and space is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hear that, I'm like, yeah, man. You know what I mean? Like, I think that resonates with me. Let me put this next religious question to you, is that death. Where are we with that? Meaning, afterlives, is there no such thing as death?
Well, you know what? It's funny you should bring that up, because I'm going through a weird period, and I've been through this before, and I oscillate between these two thoughts. And one is that, I'm serious, Pete. I go through periods of time where I think that I'm going to live forever, and I'm really, really convinced of that.
Hmm.
I mean, I don't think I'm going to age.
Is it because you look so young?
And it's because that I don't age, yeah. You know? And I'm thinking that I really feel like I'm going to beat the rap. And that's I think so that I'm going to live as long as I want.
Yeah.
And I think that that's possible. I think one of the reasons we age and die is because we expect to age and die. Because you see other people around you and they're hobbling and they're, can you give me a hand here?
Yeah.
And that we say, well, that's the progress of life. That's the way it goes. Who says?
Yeah.
Fuck that.
God.
You know? And then there's other times that I'm convinced there's a fucking tumor in my ass. And then I just need to get a colonoscopy, and it's like literally 4 months, and I'm going to be out of here.
But I think you're articulating a thought that we all have. As soon as we're aware of death, I think the next thought hot on the heels of I die is, but not me. That I think that's everybody. But here you are, by doing your math of your stand-up, you're in your 40s.
Late 40s.
Long pause.
Very late 40s.
We look at the script of the Dharma of this conversation mm-hmm. happening. It says, Dwight, long pause, late 40s.
Well, I'm in Los Angeles, and to say your age out loud is like their police would show up if you actually admitted to being your own age.
But you could play, you know.
That's what my agent says. Yeah, he can play 35.
Yeah. You could play, not 25, but you could definitely play in your 30s, I believe. I don't know why I qualified that. Not 25, but certainly young 30s.
Yeah, and I love how we talk about Almighty Father and how there's faith, and yet I'm scared of relieving my age in Hollywood.
Yeah. I think, I don't know, I'd like to think that Hollywood will follow the way of the hipster audiences, these slacker hipsters, and be like, the premium is on how old, like Larry David, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Old guy. Hilarious guy. Nobody cares. You know what I'm saying? I'd like to think we're getting past that idea. Girls, what's her name? Lena Dunham. I love her. I think she's hilarious and amazing. And she is not typically Hollywood beautiful. You know what I mean? She'd tell you the same, I believe. Yeah. She, you know, I'm talking about her body type. And I think that's wonderful. Nobody cares. She's brilliant and entertaining. So there you go. So I hope that nobody gives a fuck that you're in your late 40s. And I'll be at the head of the pack saying, who cares? So you think, though, the more interesting thing is that you have these moments of thinking you'll never die. And I'll tell you, Dwight, my brain conjures up similar fantasies.
Okay, good.
I'll throw you one worse.
Yeah.
No, go say what you were going to say.
Well, the point is that it's not a fantasy. It's like I really have a conviction. It's like it's slightly delusional, I think.
Sure.
It's like a messiah complex or it's something that I really think that's – pertains to me. I'm thinking that other people probably have similar things, but it's like I really, really, you know, I come through these things like I am going to live forever.
Yes. It sounds like
I admit that, but then, you know, again, it oscillates. So.
Here's the thing. You're reminding me of a guy I knew, a friend of a guy I knew. His boss smoked a bunch of cigarettes all the time. And then every time he got checked up, he was fine. And they were like, look, I don't want to encourage anybody to smoke. But they said, why? How come you don't cough? You don't this? There's no problem. You seem fine. You jog. He was like an active person. And he was like, because I deny it. And he said it was completely mental. And there are a lot of new agey people that will tell you everything. I got a massage and I had a cold. And my masseuse guy is very – he's kind of Reiki-ish and like, you know, certainly in that vein. And he was like, well, it's in your head. You know what I mean? Like, and look, there's sick people listening to the show right now that want me and that guy to go fuck themselves, and I understand. But here's a guy who's smoking all the time, and he's fine. He's fine now. Let's check in 10 years. We don't know. But also here's you saying, where did I first hear that thought? We only die because we accept it. It sounds like a stoner thought, but you're saying you think there's some validity to it, which is fascinating.
It could be. I mean, it kind of goes to Deepak Chopra talks about how every 7 years you recreate every cell in your body. In
yes.
other words, 7 years ago, you were literally, in terms of molecules and atoms, a completely different human being. Why do you keep recreating yourself as aging or different in body type? What is it that controls that if every cell is changing? How come we can't make that 7 years you become stronger and younger?
Yes.
And some people would argue you have. I mean, you look young and you look better than you have ever.
That's true.
And you probably feel better than
and
you
I
have.
Do, yeah.
Right. So, you know, the 7 years ago that you were a different Pete is now you're a better Pete.
I was doughy and confused. I'm still confused.
That's the name of your next CD, isn't it?
Doughy and confused. That's a great title. Well, he talks of, and this has been coming up on the show, is when we get into, that's why I said when you're in the transcendental state, do you give yourself suggestions? Because some of the stuff that I've been reading lately quotes Deepak and says that it's in that place when he's meditating that you then have the opportunity to communicate directly to your subconscious. And your subconscious is in charge of fucking everything. How many breaths you take, what you look like, what you feel like, how you'll age,
sure.
How much body fat do you want to retain, how many moles should I grow this year? Mm-hmm. All that stuff is being – I'm getting all these orders from this thing that I have no fucking control over unless, he's saying, we go into that place and when we're in that quiet state of just being, like you're saying, then we have the line open to our inner self and we can be like, hey, let's not whatever, age –
sure.
As quickly, let's not hold on to as much fat,
or let's levitate, or let's experience the taste of Pluto, or whatever sutra. That's the key is a sutra. How do you think from that level? You know, as we're talking, we realize we're children playing with the very essences of creation, and we're it's ridiculous. What do you even talk about?
Yeah.
I mean, Einstein was the one who saw that matter is energy reduced, which is similar to the quote that Bill made, is that E equals MC squared is that brilliant idea that energy becomes matter. And if you can get to the point where you understand how to manipulate E, then you can manipulate matter. Well, no one's done that on the planet yet.
Yeah.
Or if they have, they've been very quiet about it.
Right.
And the reason is because is it possible to get to that point? I don't know, and I don't even know if it's possible.
Well,
so,
go on.
Or if you do, you become at the same time an incredibly detached in an amoral being that doesn't want to live forever or doesn't feel necessary to change molecules and whatever that you realize you just have to accept. And so,
right. Well, my friend Duncan Trussell, who has a wonderful podcast called The Duncan Trussell Family Hour, just plugged him. Not necessary. He's doing fine. Talked about enlightened people and why don't they proselytize? So let's say someone is levitating or someone is not aging. We hear stories. Wonderful stories that I would love to believe about Indian mystics who have been in the same cave for 100 years. And once a year, their followers come in and check in on them and feed them a little bit of water and then close the rock and check in on them next year. Wouldn't you just like to believe that? Isn't that like a fun story?
Yeah.
Somebody that is so spiritual that they're barely physical,
sure.
but they just have a thread connecting back to their body, keeping them alive. And then I said to Duncan, I was like, well, why aren't these people telling us about this? It's the same thing the Buddha went through. When he reached enlightenment, he didn't want to tell people.
Mm-hmm.
He reached it. And he was like, what a hassle it'll be to go into the town and see these people, and I'm going to have to find the words mm-hmm. that point. What a pain in the ass. What Duncan said was, it's like there's been a plane crash, and an enlightened person, and you crash into the North Pole, and you're in the water, and the plane is filling up with that freezing water. And an enlightened person somehow wakes up, unbuckles, goes out the emergency exit, swims to the top, climbs up on the ice, and huddles up and realizes, oh, Jesus, we were all stuck on that plane in the frozen water. I'm out here now, and you build a fire, and it's better. And then the idea of proselytizing is diving back into the water, swimming back to the plane, getting somebody who's probably dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You're risking your life. You're risking all this effort for somebody who probably doesn't even want to get out of that water. They're frozen and they're fine. And you want to be like, I got a fire going. And it's like, oh, that sounds like a lot of effort. I'll just stay here. I think I saw some peanuts floating around. You know what I mean? Isn't that interesting?
Well, it reminds me of a story that that I heard Maharishi say once, and it's a beautiful story, is that it's his description of, quote, God consciousness, which is a step beyond cosmic consciousness. I don't know why there's – and I have no idea why there's different ideas. But
yeah,
the idea is this, is that when you become it's a story about someone who was so in love with an artist's work that he wanted to go to the hometown of the artist and just experience the town, because this is the town where the artist works. And you go to town – and he goes into a restaurant, and the waiter says, "What do you want to eat?" And he goes, I really don't want to eat much. I just want to know, does he ever come in here?" And he goes, "Yes, he comes in here and eats." And he goes, "He comes in around 2 o'clock in the afternoon." He goes, "I would never want to bother him. I just want to be in the place where he is and experience it." And then he goes to the library and says, "He ever come in here?" He goes, "Yes, he comes in at 1 o'clock in the afternoon." He goes, "Well, I would never want to do that. I just want to feel someone I adore so much in the artist." And eventually, as the artist goes through town, he starts to hear about this guy. And the artist goes, "Well, when does he usually come in?" He goes, "Well, he's usually around 11 a.m. comes into the restaurant." He goes, "I think I'll show up." And the artist comes in and comes to the admirer and sits down with him at the restaurant at 11 a.m. instead of 2 p.m. And the point being is that once you adore something so thoroughly and reverently, the artist will come to you. And I think that it's a beautiful simile to be about what happens with devotion. As long as you just detach from it and go, "Look, I just want to be in it," and the artist or the quote God will come to you.
I love that so much.
It is. It's a beautiful story.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Let's go back to, you don't seem, let me guess what you might answer and save time. You don't seem too concerned with what happens when we die.
No, not at all.
It just, that's not for us to know.
No, I don't know. I'm not someone who believes that we just, I sort of quote, I think it's the atheist point of view that we wink out and never again. I just think that we happen to be on this planet at one time, and we're these entities that have been cast out from original sparks, and that we're going to finish up with this, you know, little icon and these little human semi-chimp-like bodies, and we move on into the next arena of whatever that evolution and growth is.
Perhaps in this world, maybe in another one.
Right.
It sounds like you're probably open to it. So you think, I know this is sensitive, so please don't think I'm callous. You think, do you talk to your father, your brother? I know your mother also passed.
No, I really don't. And to be honest with you, I think that I heard once that oftentimes if you go through a hard death experience, that there's this period of time where you're quiet, and it's sort of like similar to the Catholic purgatory, that you sort of that you rest.
Yeah.
And I've heard, you know, and I choose to believe that, and I think that a lot of my family sort of went through a hard time when they passed, and that they're just quiet, and that so I don't talk, and I've just sort of moved on, realizing that this is my place in time. And it's not, and I don't want to dwell on who they are or whatever happened. I'm just happy with where I am.
If there's ever been somebody that would want to come back and push you or pinch your ear or move your hand or something, don't you think it would be Bill? And again, I'm not trying to be cute. Has it ever crossed your mind that there would be some sort of?
No, it really hasn't.
Weird.
I don't know.
It's weird that every time I watch that movie, I go, I wonder if Dwight's ever taken mushrooms and tried to talk to Bill. Just being that he was that guy that when the planets align every 10,000 years, takes a bunch of mushrooms and talks to an alien. Like, that seems like...
Well, I know that there was, like, for example, I don't know if this is detailed in the movie or not, but... Bill and I had this thing when we were younger. If we were on the phone with each other and someone entered the room, we would create a code to speak to each other. And the code was, "Shall we meet at 9:20 on Green Springs?"
Uh-huh.
Or is it Green Springs? Is it 9:20? And they go, "Yeah, it's 9:20 over here." And so if someone was walking through the room, they have no idea what the conversation is, but we're communicating. So
wait, what did that mean?
What it meant was someone's in the room.
Oh.
So 9:20 meant someone was in the room. So coincidentally, Bill passed away at 11:20 Central Time, and on the West Coast, it was 9:20.
Huh.
And so that was, you know, I know I'm stretching it.
Sure.
In terms of
stretch,
serendipity.
We're in a stretchy place.
Right. But that was sort of a message to me that, you know, he passed on. But I do kind of feel like he went through a heart illness, and I kind of feel like he has rested, and he's sort of not, quote, active.
Yeah.
At least not for me. I don't.
Doesn't need to.
I rarely dream about him.
Yeah.
And so occasionally I do, and sometimes it's a very powerful.